Our next speaker is Bill Fletcher, militant trade union organizer and revolutionary theoretician in Freedom Road Organization.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. On behalf of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, I want to express my appreciation for being invited to speak before you. I also feel real good about being here, seeing a lot of old friends, some I haven't seen in a very, very long time. When I got up today, I was very excited about coming here, but I had a feeling some things were going to go wrong. So on the train up here, Amtrak decides, I guess, so that we could look at the scenery of Maryland, to stop for an hour. Then upon getting into New York and breathing some of your air, my sinuses start acting up. And then after preparing to give a 20-minute speech, Brother Abdul says, we're all going to speak for 15 minutes, right? Well, I'm going to give it a shot. At no time in the last 25 years have the storm clouds of struggle and change been spreading over this planet in the manner and form which we are currently witnessing. At no time in the last 25 years have we been more certain that things can no longer go on the way they have been, yet at the same time be less certain as to what's on the other side of the storm. The current crisis affecting socialism, for instance, is not a crisis restricted to those of us who identify as socialists, nor is this crisis restricted to the regimes which define themselves by any of the variants of Marxism, whether those regimes are in Mozambique, Mongolia, or Moldavia. The crisis which we are experiencing is a crisis integral to all of those who identify with the necessity for a radical alternative to capitalism. And in that regard, this crisis very much affects the radical or left-wing section of the African American People's Movement, the section of our movement which can best claim to be the ideological heirs of Malcolm X. Yet this is only one feature of the storm. The other is the crisis that's facing Western capitalism. And despite the collapse of the Soviet bloc and George Will's predictions that socialism has been defeated by capitalism, when we look at the picture, the situation is a bit more complex. The changing state of the U.S. economy and short-sighted policies, even from the standpoint of capitalism, have led to a situation which is almost unprecedented. Consider for a moment. We stand or sit today on the verge of a war in the Middle East. Now, generally speaking, wars pull capitalism out of the morass of depression. Yet, the ruling class is having two debates right now. One, can they actually defeat Iraq? The second is, will a war once launched bankrupt this system? As always, we of the darker persuasion find ourselves the direct and indirect victims of the madness and barbarism of capitalism. At the general level, the economy, changing from manufacturing to service, has seen a reduction in the ability of workers to get what used to be known as good-paying jobs. The ability to get a high-paying blue-collar job has decreased 14% during the 1980s, the era of the so-called Great Recovery. And instead, what we find is that people are working in low-paid and part-time jobs. The standard of living has steadily been decreasing since 1973, and the working day is being lengthened either by people begging to work overtime or being forced to work part-time jobs just to break even. For African Americans, the situation bodes very poorly. The opportunities to gain stable employment have been drying up with the smokestack industries. And though the median income for African American families have been increasing, this is only the result of greater numbers of our family members working. Also of note is that while there are many of us that are high school graduates, a greater number than the media gives us credit for having, the ability to get a job being a high school graduate is basically gone. That era is gone. Requirements for positions necessitate some level of college. During the 88 presidential campaign, then Vice presidential candidate Lloyd Benson remarked in a debate that the Reagan-Bush recovery was built upon massive debt. His analogy was something along the lines of, if he could charge up items without paying attention to covering the bill, he could guarantee a recovery as well. It was certainly one of the few good things Benson said, but it rings very true. The existing debt combined with the savings and loan debacle, along with strengthened competition from Europe and Japan, bring the U.S. close to the precipice. And rather than expressions of optimism, don't worry, be happy, the bourgeoisie is in a panic and is confused. And this most clearly came out during the debate around the federal budget. Thus, here we stand, facing a crisis of proportions barely understood, and we're beginning to hear the sounds of thunder. There is no greater moment to discuss the significance of Malcolm X or to recognize that the resurgence in his culture, in his popularity, is not a revivalist initiative, but a call to rebuild a coherent and radical pole within our movement in order to face the impending storm with a level of confidence which says in no uncertain terms that we can win. Let me amplify this point for a moment. The rise of Malcolm as symbol during the 80s after relative obscurity in the 70s, when, as was pointed out earlier, a lot of people forgot who he was, is both a criticism and a commentary. It's a criticism summed up in the slogan, "No sellout." Particularly among our youth, there is a search underway for a type and quality of leadership which represents an uncompromising stand against white supremacy and imperialism. It is also, by implication, a comment that despite the existence of powerful and progressive reform leaders such as Reverend Jackson, despite vibrant critics such as Minister Farrakhan, something is missing. What was and has been missing is not simply a leader of the stature of Malcolm, but more importantly, a visible pole among the masses of our people which carries forth the banner that he held high. Thus, the so-called resurrection of Malcolm X, as some have cynically called it, is more than a call to return to the statements and views of a brother long since gone, but a call for a new type of leadership of our movement and a renewal of purpose for the radical section of our movement. Besides a recognition of the necessity for militance and uncompromising struggle for black liberation, I want to touch on three issues that I think are significant that carry on from Malcolm. One is the question of black unity and struggle. The second is the question of the black left. And the third is our relationship to other people of color. One feature of the current situation is the growing income polarization within U.S. society generally, and what is not discussed often, within Afro-America itself. In U.S. society as a whole, the gap between rich and poor is greatest since, has never been as great since the American Revolution. This is a result of Reagan-Bush administration policies and the decline of industry. But there's also something else going on, which is within Afro-America. In large part as a result of the struggles of the 60s and 70s, white corporate America was compelled to respond to our people's demands for justice. The problem, for lack of a better word, came in the nature of the response. And in fact, the problem resulted to a great extent from an issue which Malcolm put on the agenda before he died. In other words, to the extent to which the African American struggle was successfully confined within the borders of civil rights, there could be a profound limitation on the ability to address the fundamental question of our oppression. The white ruling class shaped the nature of the civil rights victory in such a way that it promoted the development of a very contradictory black middle class. Contrary to the pre-1960s black middle class, which was based largely on dynamics within our community, the new middle class owed a large part of its growth and birth either to its direct relationship to white corporate America or indirectly through the growth of community action and poverty programs. This new sector has had a mixed relationship to the politics of black liberation. In some cases, they have been champions of black empowerment struggles, such as in the case of the successful struggle to elect Harold Washington, the late Harold Washington, mayor of Chicago. On the other hand, elements of the same class have gravitated towards various forms of neoconservatism, and traditional Democratic Party politics, renouncing the movements and struggles which put them where they are today. This development places a problem before black radicals, a problem which Malcolm was attempting to address, though in a very different context. Putting it simply and somewhat provocatively, to what extent is black unity relevant in the 1990s? The key to the answer to this can actually be found in Malcolm's practice. Malcolm found himself consistently at odds with the black leadership of his time. He did not hesitate from calling them out for any practice which he believed was misleading Afro-America. At the same time, he attempted to find means to cooperate with some sections of this same leadership. This was not a form of opportunism, nor was it confusion on his part. It was a recognition that white supremacist national oppression, which we as African Americans face daily, and which exists as the basic cement holding U.S. capitalism together, has an impact on all sections of our people, though to different degrees and extents. The issue for Malcolm, as it should be for ourselves, was to find a means to mobilize those sectors of our population, of African Americans, where a recognition of a common problem, be it tactical or strategic, couldn't be identified. Putting it in another way, key to black liberation was and remains the question of a united front. This, in fact, leads to the second point. During a good part of the 60s and 70s, the left wing of the African American People's Movement found itself at odds with the black middle class led and influenced organizations. Rather than attempting to identify any basis of unity, the practice common to most of our movement, irrespective of one's organizational identity, was to trash our opponents. Following the downturn in the struggle and the collapse of many super revolutionary organizations, this practice flip-flopped to one of often tailing black reformers. This especially surfaced when many black radicals, which had completely repudiated the electoral struggle, found that the masses jumped way ahead of us in the 1980s. But with the decline of the electoral upsurge and the more apparent class contradictions and polarizations among African Americans, a conclusion has been reached in some sections, incorrectly but reached nevertheless, that there is no longer a basis for black unity. What Malcolm was trying to build, the project which he was undertaking, to put it in another way, was the construction of a radical pole within our movement. He did not look at this as in contradiction to black unity. In fact, it was something that was going hand in hand with the effort to build the United Front. The work to build the Organization for Afro-American Unity was not only an effort to promote unity among Afro-Americans, but to pose before African Americans as a whole a new force, indeed a radical force, representing a different vision for black liberation. In so doing, he was also advancing a new set of politics relevant to all those forces which were prepared to challenge imperialism and racism, irrespective of their nationality or so-called race. Lacking from our current situation is such a pole of black radicalism. Yes, there is a left wing of our movement. We have organizations, collectives, bookstores, study groups, independent activists. And while it's important to emphasize all of this and to recognize that most of us have bases in our communities, at the same time, a pole of black radicalism does not exist. The construction of such a pole, which means building unity among the black left, remains the key task for all of those of us who identify with Malcolm's legacy. There's a long and strong tradition of black radicalism for us to build upon, a tradition certainly going back as far as the slave revolts. Radicalism is a credible position within our community, even for those people who do not accept our overall program. Each of us today probably have relatives and ancestors who were members or still are of explicitly radical black or multinational groups, relatives or ancestors who were known as race men or race women, or those that were simply known as good fighters for the people. Malcolm was building on that tradition, our people's tradition of radical oration and radical activism. And this falls before us as a task of overwhelming proportions, but a task which nevertheless must be accomplished if we are to move our people out of the present level of oppression and depression. The radicalism which we developed for the 90s and 21st century must be a radicalism which, as with Malcolm, speaks to the grassroots of our people. It must be a radicalism which identifies with a common person and speaks their language. It must, to put it in other terms, be a black radicalism which speaks to, for, and through the black working class. In using Malcolm's famous metaphor of the house Negro and the field Negro, we must recognize that the metaphor objectively spoke to class politics among our people and not simply people's subjective intentions. So too is this true here now. Not only are there efforts by different classes among African Americans to construct black liberation in terms which are favorable to their class interests, but so too is it true that black radicalism will be shaped by the extent to which it includes the needs, desires, and input of the black working class, or, in the alternative, is shaped outside of their experience. If we are to be true to Malcolm's legacy, our radicalism must be a message from the grassroots. The final point I want to touch on, and I've just been given the five-minute notice, is an issue that many people move over in looking at Malcolm, but if you read many of his speeches, it was a matter that preoccupied him. It was the question of the relationship of our struggle to other non-white peoples, other third world peoples, other people of color. Throughout many of his speeches and interviews, he returns to this question of Bandung. And I would assert that so should we. Bandung, as you will remember, is the Indonesian city which in 1955 was the site of an historic summit of nations of Africa, the Middle East, and East Asia. This summit laid the basis for what has come to be known as the Non-Aligned Movement. Malcolm was intrigued with this summit and with the efforts which were made to construct a common agenda, irrespective of ideological and national differences, to face Western imperialism. He called attention to its significance as well as to the efforts by imperialism to sow differences among various peoples of color. And I would assert that the issue of Bandung and the symbolism is something that we need to bring on home. Because we're living in a situation in the United States where this country is undergoing some very profound changes. Some of these have been spoken to already. And in these changes, in the changes in the population of this country, by the year 2000, one-third of this population will be people of color. We, instead of seeing building unity, we see growing contradictions. African Americans against Latinos, African Americans against Asians, Latinos fighting Asians, on and on. And who is the beneficiary of this but the imperialists? Now, I'm restricting this to this part of my speech because I don't have much time, but I do want to spend a minute referring to the issue between African Americans and Latinos. Because in the black electoral upsurge, black folks would not have been elected in many cities had it not been for the clear support of Latinos. And then what happens? What happens is you get some stupid-ass remarks that are made by some black elected officials defaming Puerto Rican political prisoners. You have insensitivity shown. You have insensitivity shown to the political needs and aspirations of the Latino population. And then to add insult to injury, you find black politicians who will not mobilize their constituencies to support Latino candidates. We've got to bring this to an end. We've got to bring it to an end. So we need to return to the theme of Bandung. Malcolm linked the issue of Bandung to the struggles for independence in Africa. In other words, he took the issue of the summit, the idea of building unity of people of color, he linked that with the national struggle. There's no contradiction. It is something that we can develop here. In the United States, for a number of years, many African-American activists have been considering a means to do just that, to bring activists of color together, to find a means to work together. While rainbow politics is a step in that direction, it is not the completion of it. An opportunity now exists to build on Malcolm's concern about the unity of people of color. Indeed, 1992 is probably as good and as ironic a year to initiate a Bandung West summit of people of color in the United States, and perhaps also, if we want to be ambitious, Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean as well. With 1992 representing the 500th anniversary of the coming of Columbus to the Western Hemisphere and the launching of, of Columbus to the Western Hemisphere and the launching of countless wars of enslavement, colonialism, and extermination, we have an excellent symbolic moment in history to bring together people of color, to reflect on our current situation and not simply have a conference, but to map out a battle plan, to map out an agenda, to map out a common approach to dealing with white supremacist national oppression. No, I'm not calling for a summit for the sake of a meeting. God help us from such meetings. Nor is this an announcement of a pending gathering. And I see the brother approaching. I'm wrapping up, folks. It is the raising of a task which can be a substantive step in the direction of altering political power in the United States. With the United States changing every day, the future lies in the hands of people of color. Either to the extent that we take on the role of mapping out that future, reshaping as we do all other progressive social movements, or to the extent to which we allow that future to be determined for us. I can think of no better way to honor the memory of Malcolm X than to bring his concern and hope to fruition. Thank you very much.